This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. There are four species of carp, big head, black, grass, silver, that are not native to U.S. waterways. But since the 1970s, their populations have been growing. They're considered invasive because they compete with native species and can destroy habitats. Scientists are working to keep these carp from spreading further into American waterways, especially the Great Lakes. And this year, they're looking into a strategy that uses sound. You can always count on the 21st to put the wattage in your cottage. Okay, the Army Corps is not actually playing Motley Crue, Kickstart My Heart, but as we'll hear later, one of the sounds they are using does have a lot in common with that rising pitch at the beginning of that track. Another sound is meant to remind the fish of a type of dolphin that eats them in their native waters. The idea behind all this is to keep the fish from moving upstream. Here to tell us more about the new acoustic deterrent system is U.S. Geological Survey scientist Mary Beth Bray. She's a research fish biologist. Mary Beth, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Krista Woodley, bioacoustics team lead with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Krista, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. We're excited to talk with you today.
And listeners, if you want to join our conversation, you can do so by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. If you have been on Illinois waterways and encountered some of these carp, those are always interesting stories. Or if you just have a question about using sound to try and keep carp from moving upstream, 800-222-9455. Mary Beth, let's go back to basics here. I'm sure our listeners have heard about carp over the years, but it's always worth remembering. Why are these types of carp, big head, black, grass, silver, they're often referred to collectively as Asian carp, why are they threatening to the Great Lakes ecosystem?
Yeah, so a major issue is that they eat a lot. So they're filter feeding fish, the big head carp and silver carp, and grass carp eat vegetation, black carp eat mussels. And so all of these have populations that reproduce very quickly. They have large numbers and they eat a lot. And so the big head and silver specifically are just going through the water column, filtering everything that comes through their mouth. And that's food that's being taken away from native species that are filter feeders like big mouth buffalo. And the big concern for the Great Lakes is that that has huge fisheries, and the impacts to the Great Lakes are largely unknown, but thought to be major if the carp populations get into those Great Lakes.
So how close are we to this danger, to this, you know, maybe dam breaking is not the right metaphor to use with people who work with the Corps of Engineers, but where are we on this?
Yeah, I won't use dam breaking, but we're fish are downstream near Brandon Road Lock and Dam in the Illinois River, or I'm sorry, at Dresden Island Lock and Dam in the Illinois River, right at the Des Plaines River there. So fish are close, but both state and federal agencies have been working really hard over past 10 years, really, to kind of keep fish at the locations that they're at. It's a lot of work. And so we're always looking for other technologies, deterrents, fish removal techniques, anything that we can add on to make sure that these fish either stay where they're at or we move them back downstream and kind of decrease the population size.
And Krista, maybe can you talk about how these carp found their way here in the first place? I mean, we've mentioned that they're not native.
Yes. So the fish actually were introduced to the United States via biological techniques, control techniques that the USDA wanted to use back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, depending on which species you're referring to. And over time, the thought was that many of the fish would be brought in and they would be reproductively incapable of reproducing. But this was obviously before Jurassic Park had its famous theme of biology will always find a way. It's very true. Biology does find its way, and over several generations, they became reproducing populations. You add that in with the fact that sometimes eggs just escape, the eggs of the fish escape, or the larvae escape through the aquaculture system. They get into the general waterways. If it's a southern population and we have a nice flooding event or a natural disaster, the fish can be brought in that way as well. So it's kind of a combination of a variety of factors, and it just really depends on which location and which species we examine for that particular area as to how they made it into our navigable and public waterways.
So can you, Krista, also talk then about what sort of things have been tried before we get to these sort of acoustic attempts, but what are some of the other solutions that have been tried in the past to help control these species of carp, and how successful were they?
Well, there's been some very aggressive solutions and some solutions that were attempted that were not as capable. So one of the old fisheries biology techniques is to use a chemical such as copper or rotenone and actually kill fish in a enclosed population, enclosed area. That's a really difficult response. We know so much more about the chemicals and the long-term effects that they have on our watersheds. We don't really want to go that route. It also leaves a large environmental footprint, so to speak, in the fact that it kills off everything within that watershed. So you're not just taking out the carp, but you're taking out all the native species, and especially those that may be sensitive. Other techniques have been tried, things like air bubble curtains to flush them out with different flows, attractants, and electricity. Electricity is one of the larger, one of the more popular, more larger types of techniques that the Army Corps uses right now. At the Chicago area waterways, we have an electrical barrier there. It's actually several barriers that we use. One of the costs to that, though, is human safety, navigation safety, and infrastructure safety. So it's a very good deterrent. It's doing its job quite well. It also has these other environmental costs that the acoustic deterrent system doesn't have. The acoustic deterrent system has a smaller environmental footprint relative to, we're not going to cause any type of organic or water pollution. We don't have effects on navigation where people could fall in the water and get shocked. So it's a technique we hope that sort of meets between these other techniques that have been adopted and used in the past that are still as effective.
Okay, let's get into what this acoustic system is then. Mary Beth Bray, you're a research fish biologist, a USGS scientist. What exactly, what does this system consist of? Where are the acoustic deterrents being set up?
So the system that we're working on right now is located between Keokuk, Iowa and Hamilton, Illinois, at Lock and Dam 19 on the Mississippi River. So it's the upper Mississippi River. It is a series of 16 speakers that was designed with the Corps of Engineers and an A&E firm that we've brought in. So the Corps designed the structure that holds these speakers. And we worked with the A&E to come up with the design to route the cables up to the surface and to the trailer that we're projecting equipment from. And so the speakers themselves are located in what we call the last discharge lateral. So in the lock approach, as you're going into the lock, there's a series of slots, kind of look a little bit like toaster slots in that downstream approach. And recessed into one of those is a weldment, so a long structure that holds 16 speakers, so that as vessels go over that, they don't hit those speakers. So they're recessed there. The cables run up through to the surface, and then we play the sound from here. So the sound bar, as we've called it in the past, projects sound down into the approach channel, and that sound level decreases as you move downstream.
Okay, we actually have an example here of what one of these sounds like. This is the one that has been compared to the Motley Crue song we heard a little earlier. Let's take a listen to that. Okay, I am deterred by that. Mary Beth, why does this work on fish? What is the idea here?
Yeah, there's a couple ideas, and I'll let Krista talk a little bit about that too. Sure. We've been working with the Army Corps and ERDC, University of Minnesota Duluth, to kind of determine what sounds fish can hear, so hearing tests. And then Chris has been working at ERDC to use sounds that may deter fish. So something that sounds like they're a predator may be coming at them. So that Doppler effect where it rises as something's getting closer. And then the frequencies that are used within that try to stay within the carp hearing range. And then hopefully outside of human generated sounds that might be occurring in the lock approach. And she can speak a little more on how some of the sounds were developed, but the general sense is something that they perceive as a threat.
Okay. Yeah, Krista, how about that? I guess when I first saw just the headline on this study, I was kind of hoping that it would be like, you know, the flipper, you know, sound effects or something like that played underwater, because I read something about, you know, reminding the fish of hungry dolphins from their native waters. But I gather it's a little more technical than that. Maybe you can talk about that aspect.
You know, it's really a combination of things, as Mary Beth mentioned. So the loudness is one factor, and we, you know, you could refer to that as decibels as well. The frequency range, what the fish can actually hear, and then a combination of patterns of sound. And so when you take those three major aspects, the first thing you want to do is make it seem like a threat is always approaching the fish. And from there, that threat has to be something that they understand to be a threat. So you can either take on their, what I call current education, their short-term and long-term memory, which is a perfect example of the boat sounds that Mary Beth has mentioned before in prior interviews, and a sound that was worked on by USGS in prior years. So if you take the elements of that signal and then you intermix it, you come up with these various patterns that are threatening to the fish. And depending on the pattern, the behavior goes anywhere from turn around and escape, you know, as a typical fright response, to a complete freeze response where they hold position and they don't move until that sound pattern lets up. As for the dolphin reference, there's elements within the sound, and that's called alocene. And what happens is during the alocene effect, it allows us to pick on random patterns that are being generated by the signal itself at higher frequency levels. So you're allowed to pump in at a very loud decibel level the frequency that is strong and creates a particular behavior, and then bring in another type of higher pitch frequency at the same time. And that brings in the upper level hearing of dolphins. It doesn't sound specifically like a dolphin or a dolphin call, but it is within the same frequency band.
So much for my flipper hypothesis. Okay, only about a minute left in our conversation, unfortunately. Mary Beth, let me just close with you then. What does success look like here? Briefly.
Yeah, I think success is a couple different things. One of those is us being able to deploy the system, have it operate for an extended period of time. So we're here for up to 3 years as a study. So as researchers, we're really looking to determine, is this possible to be used in the future? And we're here to figure out whether it's a possibility and provide that information to resource managers. So that in and of itself, getting the system in, operating, monitoring fish behavior is a huge success for us. The second one is then being able to transfer the technology to somewhere else. And so if this does work, if it's effective to any level and that managers agree would be useful somewhere else, it's transferring the technology to management agencies to work at places like Brandon Road Lock and Dam with the multi-deterrent system, taking the tour on the road, it sounds like.
So we're gonna have to leave it there, unfortunately. Sorry to interrupt, but we are out of time. I want to thank Mary Beth Bray, a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and Krista Woodley, who is bioacoustics team lead with the Army Corps of Engineers. Thank you both for being here. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.